cocking his stout glance on the power of his voice, sent to him and bade him dwell in Gondolin and be in his favor, and abide even within the royal halls, if he would. Then Tuor, for he was weary, and that place was fair, said, Yea, and hence cometh the abiding of Tuor in Gondolin. Of all Tuor's deeds among the Gondolin the tales tell not. But he said that many a time would he have stolen thence, growing weary of the concourses of folk, and thinking of empty forest and fell, or hearing afar the sea music of Ulmo, had not his heart been filled with love for a woman of the Gondolin, and she was a daughter of the king. Now Tuor learnt many things in those realms, taught by Veronwe, whom he loved, and who loved him exceeding greatly in return. Or else was he instructed by the skilled men of the city and the wise men of the king. Wherefore he became a man far mightier than aforetime, and wisdom was in his counsel. And many things became clear to him that were unclear before, and many things known that are still unknown to mortal men. There he heard concerning that city of Gondolin, and how unstaying labor through ages of years had not sufficed to its building and adornment whereat folk travailed yet. Note 20. Folk, original reading, men. This is the only place where men, in reference to elves, is changed. The use is constant in The Fall of Gondolin, and even occurs once in an odd-sounding reference to the hosts of Melko, but now the men of Melko have assembled their forces. Page 183. End of note. Of the delving of that hidden tunnel he heard, which the folk named the Way of Escape, and how there had been divided counsels in that matter. Yet pity for the enthralled Noldali had prevailed in the end to its making. Of the guard without ceasing, he was told, that was held there in arms, and likewise at certain low places in the encircling mountains, and how watchers dwelt ever vigilant on the highest peaks of that range, beside builded beacons ready for the fire. For never did that folk cease to look for an onslaught of the orcs, did their stronghold become known. Now, however, was the guard of the hills maintained rather by custom than necessity, for the Gondolin had long ago, with unimagined toil, levelled and cleared and delved all that plain about Amon Gwareth, so that scarce gnome or bird or beast or snake could approach, but was espied from many leagues off. For among the Gondolin were many whose eyes were keener than the very hawks of Manwë Sulemo, lord of gods and elves, who dwells upon Thaniquetil. And for this reason did they call that vale Fumladen, or the Valley of Smoothness. Now this great work was finished to their mind, and folk were the busier about the quarrying of metals and the forging of all manner of swords and axes, spears and bills, and the fashioning of coats of mail, durnies and hauberks, greaves and vambraces, helms and shields. Now 'twas said to Tuor that already the whole folk of Gondolin, shooting with bows without stay, day or night, might not expend their hoarded arrows in many years, and that yearly their fear of the orcs grew the less for this. There learnt Tuor of building with stone, of masonry, and the hewing of rock and marble. Crafts of weaving and spinning, broidure and painting did he fathom, and cunning in metals. Music's most delicate he there heard, and in these were they who dwelt in the southern city the most deeply skilled, for there played a profusion of murmuring founts and springs. Many of these subtleties Tuor mastered and learned to entwine with his songs to the wonder and heart's joy of all who heard. Strange stories of the sun and moon and stars, of the manner of the earth and its elements, and of the depths of heaven were told to him. And the secret characters of the elves he learnt, and their speeches and old tongues, and heard tell of Ilúvatar, the Lord for always, who dwelleth beyond the world. Of the great music of the Ainur about Ilúvatar's feet in the uttermost deeps of time, whence came the making of the world and the manner of it, and all therein and their governance. Note 21. The passage ending here and beginning with the words, Then Tuor's heart was heavy, on page 162, was bracketed by my father in Tuor B, and on a loose slip referring to this bracketed passage, he wrote, If necessary, then is told how Idril, daughter of the king, added her words to the king's wisdom, so that Turgon bid Tuor rest himself a while in Gondolin, and being forewise prevailed on him to abide there in the end. how he came to love the daughter of the king, Idril of the Silver Feet, and how he was taught deeply in the lore of that great folk, and learned of its history and the history of the elves, how Tuor grew in wisdom and mighty in the councils of the Gondolin. The only narrative difference here from the actual text lies in the introduction of the king's daughter Idril as an influence on Tuor's decision to remain in Gondolin. The passage is otherwise an extremely abbreviated summary of the account of Tuor's instruction in Gondolin, with omission of what is said in the text about the preparations of the Gondolin against attack. But I do not think that this was a proposal for shortening the written tale. Rather, the words, if necessary, suggest strongly that my father had in mind only a reduction for oral delivery, and that was when it was read to the Exeter College Essay Club in the spring of 1920, see page 147. Another proposed shortening is given in note 32. End of note. Now for his skill and his great mastery over all lore and craft whatsoever, and his great courage of heart and body, did Tuor become a comfort and stay to the king who had no son. And he was beloved by the folk of Gondolin. Upon a time the king caused his most cunning artificers to fashion a suit of armor for Tuor as a great gift, and it was made of gnome steel overlaid with silver. But his helm was adorned with a device of metals and jewels like to two swan wings, one on either side, and a swan's wing was wrought on his shield. But he carried an axe rather than a sword, and this in the speech of the Gondolin he named Dromboleg, for its buffet stunned and its edge clove all armor. A house was built for him upon the southern walls, for he loved the free airs and liked not the close neighborhood of other dwellings. There it was his delight often to stand on the battlements at dawn, and folk rejoiced to see the new light catch the wings of his helm, and many murmured and would fain have backed him into battle with the orcs, seeing that the speeches of those two, Tuor and Turgon, before the palace were known to many. But this matter went not further for reverence of Turgon, and because at this time in Tuor's heart the thought of the words of Ulmo seemed to have grown dim and far off. Now came days when Tuor had dwelt among the Gondolin many years. Long had he known and cherished a love for the king's daughter, and now was his heart full of that love. Great love, too, had Idril for Tuor, and the strands of her fate were woven with his even from that day when first she gazed upon him from a high window as he stood a way-worn suppliant before the palace of the king. Little cause had Turgon to withstand their love, for he saw in Tuor a kinsman of comfort and great hope. Thus was first wed a child of men with a daughter of Elfenesse. Nor was Tuor the last. Less bliss have many had than they, and their sorrow in the end was great. Yet great was the mirth of those days when Idril and Tuor were wed before the folk in Gar Ainion, the place of the gods, nigh to the king's halls. A day of merriment was that wedding to the city of Gondolin, and of the greatest happiness to Tuor and Idril. Note 22. This passage beginning Great Love Too Had Idril for Tuor was written on a separate slip and replaced the original text as follows. The king hearing of this and finding that his child Idril, whom the Eldar speak of as Irilde, loved Tuor in return. He consented to their being wed, seeing that he had no son. And Tuor was like to make a kinsman of strength and consolation. There were Idril and Tuor wed before the folk in that place of the gods, Gar Ainion, nigh the king's palace. And that was a day of mirth to the city of Gondolin, but of, etc. The replacement states that the marriage of Tuor and Idril was the first but not the last of the unions of man and elf. Whereas it is said in the name list of the fall of Gondolin, that Earendil was the only being that is half of the kindred of the Eldalie and half of men. See page 215. End of note. Thereafter dwelt they in joy in that house upon the walls that looked out south over Tumladen, and this was good to the hearts of all in the city, save Meglin alone. Now that gnome was come of an ancient house, though now were its numbers less than others, but he himself was nephew to the king by his mother, the king's sister Isfin. And that tale of Isfin and Eol may not here be told. Note 23. The phrase, and that tale of Isfin and Eol may not here be told, was added to Tuor B, see page 220. End of note. Now the sign of Meglin was a sable mole, and he was great among quarrymen and a chief of the delvers after ore. And many of these belonged to his house. Less fair was he than most of this goodly folk, swart and of none too kindly mood, so that he won small love, and whispers there were that he had orc's blood in his veins. But I know not how this could be true. Now he had bid often with the king for the hand of Idril, yet Turgon, finding her very loath, had as often said nay, for him seemed Meglin's suit was caused as much by the desire of standing in high power beside the royal throne as by love of that most fair maid. Fair indeed was she, and brave thereto. And the people called her Idril of the Silver Feet, in that she went ever barefoot and bareheaded, king's daughter as she was, save only at pomps of the Ainur. And Meglin gnawed his anger, seeing Tuor thrust him out. Footnote, Silver Feet, faintly penciled above in Tuor B, Idril Talkeleb. End of footnote. In these days came to pass the fulfillment of the time of the desire of the Valar and the hope of the Eldalie, for in great love Idril bore to Tuor a son, and he was called Earendel. Now thereto there are many interpretations, both among elves and men, but belike it was a name wrought of some secret tongue among the Gondothlim, and that has perished with them from the dwellings of the earth. Note 24. Original reading, a name wrought of the tongue of the Gondothlim. End of note. Now this babe was of greatest beauty, his skin of a shining white and his eyes of a blue surpassing that of the sky in southern lands, bluer than the sapphires of the raiment of Manwë. Note 25. The sapphires given to Manwë by the Nordali are referred to in the tale of the coming of the elves, 1-128. The original penciled text of Tuor A can be read here, bluer than the sapphires of Sulimo. End of note. And the envy of Meglin was deep at his birth, but the joy of Turgon and all the people very great indeed. Behold, now many years have gone since Tuor was lost amid the foothills and deserted by those Noldali. Yet many years, too, have gone since to Melko's ears came first those strange tidings, faint were they and various in form, of a man wandering amid the dales of the waters of Sirion. Now Melko was not much afraid of the race of men in those days of his great power, and for this reason did Ulmo work through one of this kindred for the better deceiving of Melko, seeing that no Valar and scarce any of the Eldar or Noldali might stir unmarked of his vigilance. Yet nonetheless forebodings smote that ill heart at the tidings, and he got together a mighty army of spies. Sons of the Orcs were there, with eyes of yellow and green, like cats that could pierce all glooms and see through mist or fog or night, snakes that could go every whither and search all crannies or the deepest pits or the highest peaks, listen to every whisper that ran in the grass or echoed in the hills. Wolves there were, and ravening dogs, and great weasels full of the thirst of blood, whose nostrils could take scent moons old through running water, or whose eyes find among shingle footsteps that had passed a lifetime since. Owls came, and falcons, whose keen glance might descry by day or night the fluttering of small birds in all the woods of the world, and the movement of every mouse or vole or rat that crept or dwelt throughout the earth. All these he summoned to his hall of iron, and they came in multitudes. Thence he sent them over the earth to seek this man who had escaped from the land of shadows, but yet far more curiously and intently to search out the dwelling of the Noldali that had escaped his thraldom. For these his heart burnt to destroy or to enslave. Now while Tuor dwelt in happiness and in great increase of knowledge and might in Gondolin, these creatures through the years untiring nosed among the stones and rocks, hunted the forests and the heaths, espied the airs and lofty places, tracked all paths about the dales and plains, and neither let nor stayed. From this hunt they brought a wealth of tidings to Melko. Indeed, among many hidden things that they dragged to light, they discovered that way of escape, whereby Tuor and Voronwë entered aforetime. Nor had they done so save by constraining some of the less stout of the Noldali with dire threats of torment to join in that great ransacking. For because of the magic about that gate, no folk of Melko, unaided by the gnomes, could come to it. Yet now they had pried of late far into its tunnels, and captured within many of the Nordali, creeping there to flee from thraldom. They had scaled, too, the encircling hills at certain places, and gazed upon the beauty of the city of Gondolin and the strength of Amon Gwareth from afar. Footnote, encircling hills, penciled above in Tuor B, Heborodin. End of footnote. But into the plain they could not win for the vigilance of its guardians and the difficulty of those mountains. Indeed, the Gondothlim were mighty archers, and bows they made of a marvel of power. Therewith might they shoot an arrow into heaven 7 times as far as could the best bowman among men shoot at a mark upon the ground, and they would have suffered no falcon to hover long over their plain, or snake to crawl therein, for they liked not creatures of blood, broodlings of Melko. Now in those days was Earendel 1 year old when these ill tidings came to that city of the spies of Melko, and how they encompassed the vale of Tumladen around. Then Turgon's heart was saddened, remembering the words of Tuor in past years before the palace doors. And he caused the watch and ward to be thrice strengthened at all points, and engines of war to be devised by his artificers and set upon the hill. Poisonous fires and hot liquids, arrows and great rocks, was he prepared to shoot down on any who would assail those gleaming walls. And then he abode as well content as might be, but Tuor's heart was heavier than the king's. For now the words of Ulmo came ever to his mind, and their purport and gravity he understood more deeply than of old. Nor did he find any great comfort in Idril, for her heart boded more darkly even than his own. Know then that Idril had a great power of piercing with her thought the darkness of the hearts of elves and men, and the glooms of the future thereto. Further even than is the common power of the kindreds of the Eldalie. Therefore she spake thus on a day to Tuor, "Know, my husband, that my heart misgives me for doubt of Meglin, and I fear that he will bring an ill on this fair realm, though by no means may I see how or when. Yet I dread lest all that he knows of our doings and preparations become in some manner known to the foe, so that he devise a new means of whelming us, against which we have thought of no defense. Lo, I dreamed on a night that Meglin builded a furnace, and coming at us unawares, flung therein Earendel our babe, and would after thrust in thee and me, but that for sorrow at the death of our fair child I would not resist." And Tuor answered, "There is reason for thy fear, for neither is my heart good towards Meglin. Yet is he the nephew of the king and thine own cousin, or is there charge against him, and I see naught to do but to abide and watch." But Idril said, "This is my rede thereto. Gather thou in deep secret those delvers and quarrymen who by careful trial are found to hold least love for Meglin by reason of the pride and arrogance of his dealings among them. From these thou must choose trusty men to keep watch upon Meglin, whenso he fares to the outer hills. Yet I counsel thee to set the greater part of those in whose secrecy thou canst confide at a hidden delving, and to devise with their aid, howsoever cautious and slow that labor be, a secret way from thy house, here beneath the rocks of this hill under the vale below. Now this way must not lead toward the way of escape, for my heart bids me trust it not, but even to that far distant pass, the cleft of eagles in the southern mountains, and the further this delving reach thitherward beneath the plain, so much the better would I esteem it. Yet let all this labor be kept dark, save from a few. Now there are none such delvers of earth or rock as the Nordali, and this Melko knows. But in those places is the earth of a great hardness. And Tuor said, the rocks of the hill of Amon Gwareth are as iron, and only with much travail may they be cloven. Yet if this be done in secret, then must great time and patience be added. For the stone of the floor of the vale of Tumladen is as forged steel, or may it be hewn without the knowledge of the Gondothlim, save in moons and years. Idril said then, sooth this may be, but such is my rede, and there is yet time to spare. Then Tuor said that he might not see all its purport. But better is any plan than a lack of counsel, and I will do even as thou sayest. Now it so chanced, that not long after Meglin went to the hills for the getting of ore, and straying in the mountains alone, was taken by some of the orcs prowling there. And they would do him evil and terrible hurt, knowing him to be a man of the Gondolfin. This was, however, unknown of Tuor's watchers. But evil came into the heart of Meglin, and he said to his captors, "Know then that I am Meglin, son of Eol, who had to wife Isfin, sister of Turgon, king of the Gondolfin." But they said, "What is that to us?" And Meglin answered, "Much is it to you. For if you slay me, be it speedy or slow, ye will lose great tidings concerning the city of Gondolin that your master would rejoice to hear." Then the orcs stayed their hands, and said they would give him life if the matters he opened to them seemed to merit that. And Meglin told them of all the fashion of that plain and city, of its walls, and their heights, and thickness, and the valor of its gates, of the host of men at arms who now obeyed Turgon, he spake, and the countless hoard of weapons gathered for their equipment, of the engines of war and the venomous fires. Then the orcs were wroth, and having heard these matters, were yet for slaying him there and then as one who impudently enlarged the power of his miserable folk to the mockery of the great might and puissance of Melko. But Meglin, catching at a straw, said, "Think ye not that ye would rather pleasure your master if he bore to his feet so noble a captive that he might hear my tidings of himself and judge of their verity?" Now this seemed good to the orcs, and they returned from the mountains about Gondolin to the hills of Iron and the dark halls of Melko. Thither they hailed Meglin with them, and now was he in a sore dread. But when he knelt before the black throne of Melko in terror of the grimness of the shapes about him, of the wolves that sat beneath that chair, and of the adders that twined about its legs, Melko bade him speak. Then told he those tidings, and Melko, hearkening, spake very fair to him, that the insolence of his heart in great measure returned. Now the end of this was that Melko, aided by the cunning of Meglin, devised a plan for the overthrow of Gondolin. For this Meglin's reward was to be a great captaincy among the orcs. Yet Melko purposed not in his heart to fulfill such a promise. But to Orr and Earendil should Melko burn, and Idril be given to Meglin's arms. And such promises was that evil one fain to redeem. Yet as meed of treachery did Melko threaten Meglin with the torment of the Balrogs. Now these were demons with whips of flame and claws of steel, by whom he tormented those of the Noldali who durst withstand him in anything, and the Eldar have called them Malkarauki. But the rede that Meglin gave to Melko was that not all the host of the orcs, nor the Balrogs in their fierceness, might by assault or siege hope ever to overthrow the walls and gates of Gondolin, even if they availed to win unto the plain without. Therefore he counseled Melko to devise out of his sorceries a succor for his warriors in their endeavor. From the greatness of his wealth of metals and his powers of fire, he bid him make beasts like snakes and dragons of irresistible might that should overcreep the encircling hills and lap that plain and its fair city in flame and death. Then Meglin was bidden fare home, lest at his absence men suspect somewhat. But Melko wove about him the spell of bottomless dread, and he had thereafter neither joy nor quiet in his heart. Nonetheless, he wore a fair mask of good liking and gaiety, so that men said, "Meglin is softened," and he was held in less disfavor. Yet Idril feared him the more. Now Meglin said, "I have labored much, and am minded to rest, and to join in the dance and the song and the merrymakings of the folk." And he went no more quarrying stone or ore in the hills. Yet in sooth he sought herein to drown his fear and disquiet. A dread possessed him that Melko was ever at hand, and this came of the spell. And he durst never again wander amid the mines, lest he again fall in with the orcs and be bidden once more to the terrors of the halls of darkness. Now the years fare by, and egged by Idril to war keepeth ever at his secret delving. But seeing that the leaguer of spies hath grown thinner, Turgon dwelleth more at ease and in less fear. Yet these years are filled by Melko in the utmost ferment of labor, and all the thrall folk of the Norderley must dig unceasingly for metals while Melko sitteth and deviseth fires and calleth flames and smokes to come from the lower heats. Nor doth he suffer any of the Norderley to stray ever a foot from their places of bondage. Then on a time Melko assembled all his most cunning smiths and sorcerers, and of iron and flame they wrought a host of monsters such as have only at that time been seen, and shall not again be till the great end. Some were all of iron so cunningly linked that they might flow like slow rivers of metal or coil themselves around and above all obstacles before them. And these were filled in their innermost depths with the grimmest of the orcs, with scimitars and spears. Others of bronze and copper were given hearts and spirits of blazing fire, and they blasted all that stood before them with the terror of their snorting, or trampled whatso escaped the ardor of their breath. Yet others were creatures of pure flame that writhed like ropes of molten metal, and they brought to ruin whatever fabric they came nigh. And iron and stone melted before them and became as water, and upon them rode the Balrogs in hundreds. And these were the most dire of all those monsters which Melko devised against Gondolin. Now when the seventh summer had gone since the treason of Meglin, and Earendel was yet of very tender years, though a valorous child, Melko withdrew all his spies, for every path and corner of the mountains was now known to him. Yet the Gondothlim thought in their unwariness that Melko would no longer seek against them, perceiving their might and the impregnable strength of their dwelling. But Idril fell into a dark mood, and the light of her face was clouded, and many wondered thereat. Yet Turgon reduced the watch and ward to its ancient numbers, and to somewhat less, and as autumn came and the gathering of fruits was over, folk turned with glad hearts to the feasts of winter. But Tuor stood upon the battlements and gazed upon the encircling hills. Now behold, Idril stood beside him, and the wind was in her hair. And Tuor thought that she was exceeding beautiful, and stooped to kiss her. But her face was sad, and she said, "Now come the days when thou must make choice." And Tuor knew not what she said. Then drawing him within their halls, she said to him how her heart misgave her for fear concerning Earendel her son, and foreboding that some great evil was nigh, and that Melko would be at the bottom of it. Then Tuor would comfort her, but might not, and she questioned him concerning the secret delving, and he said how it now led a league into the plain, and of that was her heart somewhat lightened. But still she counseled that the delving be pressed on, and that henceforth should speed weigh more than secrecy, because now is the time very near. And another rede she gave him, and this he took also, that certain of the bravest and most true among the lords and warriors of the Gondothlim be chosen with care, and told of that secret way and its issue. These she counseled him to make into a stout guard, and to give them his emblem to wear, that they become his folk. And to do thus under pretext of the right and dignity of a great lord, kinsman to the king. Moreover, said she, I will get my father's favor to that. In secret, too, she whispered to folk that if the city came to its last stand, or Turgon be slain, that they rally about Tuor and her son. And to this they laughed a yea, saying, however, that Gondolin would stand as long as Tanyquetil or the mountains of Valinor. Yet to Turgon she spoke not openly, nor suffered Tuor to do so as he desired, despite their love and reverence for him. A great and a noble and a glorious king he was. Seeing that he trusted in Meglin and held with blind obstinacy his belief in the impregnable might of the city, and that Melko sought no more against it, perceiving no hope therein. Now in this he was ever strengthened by the cunning sayings of Meglin. Behold, the guile of that gnome was very great, for he wrought much in the dark, so that folk said he doth well to bear the sign of a sable mole. And by reason of the folly of certain of the quarrymen, and yet more by reason of the loose words of certain among his kin, to whom word was somewhat unwarily spoken by Tuor, he gathered a knowledge of the secret work, and laid against that a plan of his own. So winter deepened, and it was very cold for those regions, so that frost fared about the plain of Tumladen, and ice lay on its pools. Yet the fountains played ever on Amon Gwarith, and the two trees blossomed, and folk made merry till the day of terror that was hidden in the heart of Melkor. In these ways that bitter winter passed, and the snows lay deeper than ever before on the encircling hills. Yet in its time a spring of wondrous glory melted the skirts of those white mantles, and the valley drank the waters and burst into flowers. So came and passed with revelry of children the festival of Nosna Lothion, or the birth of flowers, and the hearts of the Gondolfin were uplifted for the good promise of the year. And now at length is that great feast Tarn in Austa, or the gates of summer, near at hand. For know that on a night it was their custom to begin a solemn ceremony at midnight, continuing it even to the dawn of Tarn in Austa broke. And no voice was uttered in the city from midnight till the break of day, but the dawn they hailed with ancient songs. For years uncounted had the coming of summer thus been greeted with music of choirs standing upon their gleaming eastern wall. And now comes even the night of vigil, and the city is filled with silver lamps, while in the groves upon the new-leaved trees lights of jeweled colors swing, and low musics go along the ways, but no voice sings until the dawn. The sun has sunk beyond the hills, and folk array them for the festival very gladly and eagerly, glancing in expectation to the east. Lo, even when she had gone, and all was dark, a new light suddenly began, and a glow there was, but it was beyond the northward heights, and men marveled, and there was a thronging of the walls and battlements. Note 26. The passage ending here and beginning with, "In these ways that bitter winter passed," is inserted on a separate sheet in Tuor B, but is not part of the latest layer of emendation. It replaces a much shorter passage going back to the primary text of Tuor A. "Now on midwinter's day, at early even, the sun sank betimes beyond the mountains. And lo, when she had gone, a light arose beyond the hills to the north, and men marveled," etc. See notes 34 and 37. End of note. Then wonder grew to doubt, as that light waxed and became yet redder, and doubt to dread, as men saw the snow upon the mountains dyed, as it were, with blood. And thus it was that the fire serpents of Melkor came upon Gondolin. Then came over the plain riders who bore breathless tidings from those who kept vigil on the peaks. And they told of the fiery hosts and the shapes like dragons, and said, "Melkor is upon us." Great was the fear and anguish within that beauteous city. And the streets and byways were filled with the weeping of women and the wailing of children, and the squares with the mustering of soldiers and the ring of arms. There were the gleaming banners of all the great houses and kindreds of the Gondolfin. Mighty was the array of the house of the king, and their colors were white and gold and red, and their emblems the moon and the sun and the scarlet heart. Note 27. The scarlet heart, the heart of Finwë Norlamer, Turgon's father, was cut out by orcs in the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, but it was regained by Turgon and became his emblem. See 1, 241 and note 11. End of note. Now in the midmost of these stood Tuor above all heads, and his mail of silver gleamed. And about him was a press of the stoutest of the folk. Lo, all these wore wings, as it were, of swans or gulls upon their helms, and the emblem of the white wing was upon their shields. But the folk of Meglin were drawn up in the same place, and sable was their harness, and they bore no sign nor emblem, but their round caps of steel were covered with moleskin, and they fought with axes two-headed like mattocks. There Meglin, prince of Gondobar, gathered many warriors of dark countenance and lowering gaze about him, and a ruddy glow shone upon their faces and gleamed about the polished surfaces of their accoutrement. Behold, all the hills to the north were ablaze, and it was as if rivers of fire ran down the slopes that led to the plain of Tumladen, and folk might already feel the heat thereof. And many other kindreds were there, the folk of the Swallow and the Heavenly Arch, and from these folk came the greatest number and the best of the bowmen, and they were arrayed upon the broad places of the walls. Now the folk of the Swallow bore a fan of feathers on their helms, and they were arrayed in white and dark blue, and in purple and black, and showed an arrowhead on their shields. Their lord was Duillin, swiftest of all men to run and leap, and surest of archers at a mark. But they of the Heavenly Arch, being a folk of uncounted wealth, were arrayed in a glory of colors, and their arms were set with jewels that flamed in the light now over the sky. Every shield of that battalion was of the blue of the heavens, and its boss a jewel built of 7 gems. Rubies and amethysts and sapphires, emeralds, chrysoprase, topaz, and amber. But an opal of great size was set in their helms. Egalmoth was their chieftain, and wore a blue mantle upon which the stars were broidered in crystal, and his sword was bent. Now none else of the Naudeli bore curved swords, yet he trusted rather to the bow, and shot therewith further than any among that host. There too were the folk of the Pillar and the Tower of Snow, and both these kindreds were marshalled by Penlod, tallest of gnomes. There were those of the Tree, and they were a great house, and their raiment was green. They fought with iron-studded clubs or with slings, and their lord Galdor was held the most valiant of all the Gondothlim save Turgon alone. There stood the house of the Golden Flower, who bare a rayed sun upon their shield, and their chief Glorfindel bare a mantle so broidered in threads of gold that it was diapered with celandine as a field in spring, and his arms were damascened with cunning gold. Then came there from the south of the city the people of the Fountain, and Ecthelion was their lord, and silver and diamonds were their delight. And swords very long and bright and pale did they wield, and they went into battle to the music of flutes. Behind them came the host of the Harp, and this was a battalion of brave warriors. But their leader, Salgont, was a craven, and he fawned upon Meglin. They were dight with tassels of silver and tassels of gold, and a harp of silver shone on their blazonry upon a field of black. But Salgont bore one of gold, and he alone rode into battle of all the sons of the Gondothlim, and he was heavy and squat. Now the last of the battalions was furnished by the folk of the Hammer of Wrath, and of these came many of the best smiths and craftsmen, and all that kindred reverenced Aule the smith more than all other Ainur. They fought with great maces like hammers, and their shields were heavy, for their arms were very strong. In older days they had been much recruited by Naudeli, who escaped from the mines of Melko. And the hatred of this house for the works of that evil one, and the Balrogs, his demons, was exceeding great. Now their leader was Rog, strongest of the gnomes, scarce second in valor to that Galdor of the Tree. The sign of this people was the stricken anvil, and a hammer that smiteth sparks about it was set on their shields, and red gold and black iron was their delight. Very numerous was that battalion, nor had any amongst them a faint heart, and they won the greatest glory of all those fair houses in that struggle against doom. Yet were they ill-fated, and none ever fared away from that field, but fell about Rog and vanished from the earth. And with them much craftsmanship and skill has been lost forever. Note 28. This passage describing the array and the emblems of the houses of the Gondothlim was relatively very little affected by the later revision of Tuor A. The greater part of it is in the original penciled text, which was allowed to stand, and all the names appear to be original. End of note. This was the fashion and the array of the 11 houses of the Gondothlim with their signs and emblems, and the bodyguard of Tuor, the folk of the wing, was accounted the 12th. Now is the face of that chieftain grim, and he looks not to live long. And there in his house upon the walls Idril arrays herself in mail, and seeks Earendel. And that child was in tears with the strange lights of red that played about the walls of the chamber where he slept, and tales that his nurse Meleth had woven him concerning fiery Melko at times of his waywardness came to him and troubled him. But his mother coming set about him a tiny coat of mail that she had let fashion in secret, and at that time he was glad and exceeding proud, and he shouted for pleasure. Yet Idril wept. For much had she cherished in her heart the fair city and her goodly house, and the love of Tuor and herself that had dwelt therein. But now she saw its destroying nigh at hand, and feared that her contriving would fail against this overwhelming might of the terror of the serpents. It was now 4 hours still from middle night, and the sky was red in the north and in the east and west. And those serpents of iron had reached the levels of Tumladen, and those fiery ones were among the lowest slopes of the hills, so that the guards were taken and set in evil torment by the Balrogs that scoured all about, saving only to the furthest south, where was Christhorn the Cleft of Eagles. Then did King Turgon call a council, and thither fared Tuor and Meglin as royal princes. And Duwillin came with Egalmoth and Penlod the Tall, And Rog strode thither with Galdor of the Tree and golden Glorfindel and Ecthelion of the Voice of Music. Thither too fared Salgont, a tremble at the tidings, and other nobles beside of less blood but better heart. Then spake Tuor, and this was his rede, that a mighty sally be made forthwith, ere the light and heat grew too great in the plain. And many backed him, being but of different minds as to whether the sally should be made by the entire host with the maids and wives and children amidmost, or by diverse bands seeking out in many directions, and to this last Tuor leaned. But Meglin and Salgont alone held other counsel, and were for holding to the city, and seeking to guard those treasures that lay within. Out of guile did Meglin speak thus, fearing lest any of the Nalderley escape the doom that he had brought upon them for the saving of his skin, and he dreaded lest his treason become known, and somehow vengeance find him in after days. But Salgont spake, both echoing Meglin, and being grievously afraid of issuing from the city, for he was fain rather to do battle from an impregnable fortress than to risk hard blows upon the field. Then the lord of the House of the Mole played upon the one weakness of Turgon, saying, "Lo, O king, the city of Gondolin contains a wealth of jewels and metals and stuffs and of things wrought by the hands of the gnomes to surpassing beauty. And all these lords, more brave meseems than wise, would abandon to the foe. Even should victory be thine upon the plain, thy city will be sacked, and the Balrogs get hence with a measureless booty." And Turgon groaned, for Meglin had known his great love for the wealth and loveliness of that burg upon Amon Gwarith. Note 29. The word burg is used in the Old English sense of a walled and fortified town. End of note. Again said Meglin, putting fire in his voice, "Lo, hast thou for naught labored through years uncounted at the building of walls of impregnable thickness and in the making of gates whose valor may not be overthrown? Is the power of the hill Amon Gwarith become as lowly as the deep vale, or the hoard of weapons that lie upon it and its unnumbered arrows of so little worth that in the hour of peril thou wouldst cast all aside and go naked into the open against enemies of steel and fire, whose trampling shakes the earth and the encircling mountains ring with the clamor of their footsteps?" And Salgont quaked to think of it, and spake noisily, saying, "Meglin speaks well, O king, hear thou him." Then the king took the counsel of those twain, though all the lords said otherwise. Nay, rather the more for that. Therefore, at his bidding, does all that folk abide now the assault upon their walls. But Tuor wept and left the king's hall, and gathering the men of the wing, went through the streets seeking his home. And by that hour was the light great and lurid, and there was stifling heat, and a black smoke and stench arose about the pathways to the city. And now came the monsters across the valley, and the white towers of Gondolin reddened before them. But the stoutest were in dread, seeing those dragons of fire and those serpents of bronze and iron that fare already about the hill of the city. And they shot unavailing arrows at them. Then is there a cry of hope, for behold, the snakes of fire may not climb the hill for its steepness and for its glassiness, and by reason of the quenching waters that fall upon its sides. Yet they lie about its feet, and a vast steam arises where the streams of Amon Gwarith and the flames of the serpents drive together. Then grew there such a heat that women became faint and men sweated to weariness beneath their mail, and all the springs of the city, save only the fountain of the king, grew hot and smoked. But now Gothmog, lord of Balrogs, captain of the hosts of Melko, took counsel and gathered all his things of iron that could coil themselves around and above all obstacles before them. These he bade pile themselves before the northern gate. And behold, their great spires reached even to its threshold, and thrust at the towers and bastions above it. And by reason of the exceeding heaviness of their bodies, those gates fell, and great was the noise thereof. Yet the most of the walls around them still stood firm. And the engines and the catapults of the king poured darts and boulders and molten metals on those ruthless beasts, and their hollow bellies clanged beneath the buffeting. Yet it availed not, for they might not be broken, and the fires rolled off them. Then were the topmost opened about their middles, and an innumerable host of the orcs, the goblins of hatred, poured therefrom into the breach. And who shall tell of the gleam of their scimitars, or the flash of the broad-bladed spears with which they stabbed? Then did Rog shout in a mighty voice, and all the people of the Hammer of Wrath and the kindred of the tree with Galdor the Valiant leapt at the foe. There the blows of their great hammers and the dint of their clubs rang to the encircling mountains, and the orcs fell like leaves. And those of the Swallow and the Arch poured arrows like the dark rains of autumn upon them, and both orcs and Gondolfin fell thereunder for the smoke and the confusion. Great was that battle. Yet for all their valor, the Gondolfin, by reason of the might of ever-increasing numbers, were borne slowly backwards till the goblins held part of the northernmost city. At this time is Tuor at the head of the folk of the Wings, struggling in the turmoil of the streets. And now he wins through to his house, and finds that Meglin is before him. Trusting in the battle now begun about the northern gate and in the uproar in the city, Meglin had looked to this hour for the consummation of his designs. Learning much of the secret delving of Tuor, yet only at the last moment had he got this knowledge, and he could not discover all, he said naught to the king or any other, for it was his thought that of a surety that tunnel would go in the end toward the way of escape, this being the most nigh to the city, and he had a mind to use this to his good and to the ill of the northerly. Messengers by great stealth he dispatched to Melko to set a guard about the utter issue of that way when the assault was made. But he himself thought now to take Eärendil and cast him into the fire beneath the walls, and seizing Eärendil he would constrain her to guide him to the secrets of the passage, that he might win out of this terror of fire and slaughter and drag her withal along with him to the lands of Melko. Now Meglin was afeard that even the secret token which Melko had given him would fail in that direful sack, and was minded to help that Ainu to the fulfillment of his promises of safety. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 7, The Book of Lost Tales, Part 2, by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing on page 177. No doubt had he, however, of the death of Tuor in that great burning. For to Thelgont he had confided the task of delaying him in the king's hall, and egging him straight thence into the deadliest of the fight. But lo, Thelgont fell into a terror unto death, and he rode home and lay there now a quake on his bed. But Tuor fared home with the folk of the Wing. Now Tuor did this, though his valor leapt to the noise of war, that he might take farewell of Eärendil and Eärendil, and speed them with a bodyguard down the secret way, ere he returned himself to the battle-throng to die, if must be. But he found a press of the mole-folk about his door, and these were the grimmest and least good-hearted of folk that Meglin might get in that city. Yet were they free Noldorly, and under no spell of Melko's like their master. Wherefore, though for the lordship of Meglin they aided not Eärendil, no more would they touch of his purpose despite all his curses. Now then Meglin had Eärendil by the hair, and sought to drag her to the battlements out of cruelty of heart, that she might see the fall of Eärendil to the flames. But he was cumbered by that child, and she fought, alone as she was, like a tigress for all her beauty and slenderness. There he now struggles and delays amid oaths, while that folk of the Wing draw nigh, and lo, Tuor gives a shout so great that the orcs hear it afar and waver at the sound of it. Like a crash of tempest, the guard of the Wing were amid the men of the Mole, and these were stricken asunder. When Meglin saw this, he would stab Eärendil with a short knife he had, but that child bit his left hand, that his teeth sank in, and he staggered and stabbed weakly, and the mail of the small coat turned the blade aside. And thereupon Tuor was upon him, and his wrath was terrible to see. He seized Meglin by that hand that held the knife, and broke the arm with the wrench, and then taking him by the middle, leapt with him upon the walls, and flung him far out. Great was the fall of his body, and it smote Amon Gwareth 3 times, ere it pitched in the midmost of the flames. And the name of Meglin hath gone out in shame from among Eldar and Noldorly. Then the warriors of the Mole, being more numerous than those few of the Wing, and loyal to their lord, came at Tuor, and there were great blows, that no man might stand before the wrath of Tuor, and they were smitten and driven to fly into what dark holes they might, or flung from the walls. Then Tuor and his men must get them to the battle of the gate, for the noise of it hath grown very great, and Tuor has it still in his heart that the city may stand. Yet with Edril he left there Voronwe against his will, and some other swordsman to be a guard for her, till he returned or might send tidings from the fray. Now was the battle at that gate very evil indeed, and Duwillin of the Swallow, as he shot from the walls, was smitten by a fiery bolt of the Balrogs who leapt about the base of Armand Gwara. And he fell from the battlements and perished. Then the Balrogs continued to shoot darts of fire and flaming arrows like small snakes into the sky, and these fell upon the roofs and gardens of Gondolin till all the trees were scorched, and the flowers and grass burned up, and the whiteness of those walls and colonnades was blackened and seared. Yet a worse matter was it that a company of those demons climbed upon the coils of the serpents of iron, and thence loosed unceasingly from their bows and slings, till a fire began to burn in the city to the back of the main army of the defenders. Then said Rog in a great voice, "Who now shall fear the Balrogs for all their terror? See before us the accursed ones who for ages have tormented the children of the Noldali, and who now set a fire at our backs with their shooting. Come ye of the hammer of wrath, and we will smite them for their evil." Thereupon he lifted his mace, and its handle was long, and he made a way before him by the wrath of his onset even unto the fallen gate. But all the people of the stricken anvil ran behind like a wedge, and sparks came from their eyes for the fury of their rage. A great deed was that sally, as the Noldali sing yet, and many of the orcs were borne backward into the fires below. But the men of Rog leapt even upon the coils of the serpents, and came at those Balrogs and smote them grievously. For all they had whips of flame and claws of steel, and were in stature very great. They battered them into naught, for catching at their whips wielded these against them, that they tore them even as they had aforetime torn the gnomes. And the number of Balrogs that perished was a marvel and dread to the hosts of Melko. For ere that day never had any of the Balrogs been slain by the hand of elves or men. Then Gothmog, lord of Balrogs, gathered all his demons that were about the city and ordered them thus. A number made for the folk of the hammer and gave before them. But the greater company rushing upon the flank contrived to get to their backs, higher upon the coils of the drakes and nearer to the gates, so that Rog might not win back save with great slaughter among his folk. But Rog, seeing this, essayed not to win back, as was hoped, but with all his folk fell on those whose part was to give before him. And they fled before him now of dire need rather than of craft. Down into the plain were they harried, and their shrieks rent the airs of Tumladen. Then that house of the hammer fared about smiting and hewing the astonied bands of Melko till they were hemmed at the last by an overwhelming force of the orcs and the Balrogs, and a fire drake was loosed upon them. There did they perish about Rog, hewing to the last, till iron and flame overcame them. And it is yet sung that each man of the Hammer of Wrath took the lives of 7 foemen to pay for his own. Then did dread fall more heavily still upon the Gondothlin at the death of Rog and the loss of his battalion. And they gave back further yet into the city. And Penlod perished there in a lane with his back to the wall, and about him many of the men of the Pillar and many of the Tower of Snow. Now therefore Melko's goblins held all the gate and a great part of the walls on either side, whence numbers of the Swallow and those of the Rainbow were thrust to doom. But within the city they had won a great space reaching nigh to the centre, even to the place of the well that adjoined the square of the palace. Yet about those ways and around the gate their dead were piled in uncounted heaps, and they halted therefore and took counsel, seeing that for the valour of the Gondothlin they had lost many more than they had hoped, and far more than those defenders. Fearful, too, they were for that slaughter Rog had done amid the Balrogs, because of those demons they had great courage and confidence of heart. Now then the plan that they made was to hold what they had won, while those serpents of bronze, and with great feet for trampling, climbed slowly over those of iron, and reaching the walls there opened a breach wherethrough the Balrogs might ride upon the dragons of flame. Yet they knew this must be done with speed, for the heats of those drakes lasted not forever, and might only be plenished from the wells of fire that Melko had made in the fastness of his own land. But even as their messengers were sped, they heard a sweet music that was played amid the hosts of the Gondothlin, and they feared what it might mean. And lo, there came Ecthelion and the people of the fountain, whom Turgon till now had held in reserve, for he watched the most of that affray from the heights of his tower. Now marched these folk to a great playing of their flutes, and the crystal and silver of their array was most lovely to see amid the red light of the fires and the blackness of the ruins. Then on a sudden their music ceased, and Ecthelion of the fair voice shouted for the drawing of swords, and before the orcs might foresee his onslaught, the flashing of those pale blades was amongst them. 'Tis said that Ecthelion's folk there slew more of the goblins than fell ever in all the battles of the Eldalia with that race, and that his name is a terror among them to this latest day, and a war cry to the Eldar. Now it is that Tuor and the men of the Wing fare into the fight and range themselves beside Ecthelion and those of the Fountain, and the twain strike mighty blows and ward each many a thrust from the other, and harry the orcs so that they win back almost to the gate. But there behold a quaking and a trampling, for the dragons labor mightily at beating a path up Amon Gwareth and at casting down the walls of the city. And already there is a gap therein and a confusion of masonry where the ward towers have fallen in ruin. Bands of the Swallow and of the Arch of Heaven there fight bitterly amid the wreck, or contest the walls to east and west with the foe. But even as Tuor comes nigh, driving the orcs, one of those brazen snakes heaves against the western wall, and the great mass of it shakes and falls, and behind comes a creature of fire and Balrogs upon it. Flames gust from the jaws of that worm, and folk wither before it, and the wings of the helm of Tuor are blackened. But he stands and gathers about him his guard and all of the Arch and Swallow he can find, whereas on his right Ecthelion rallies the men of the Fountain of the South. Now the orcs again take heart from the coming of the drakes, and they mingle with the Balrogs that pour about the breach, and they assail the Gondolfin grievously. There Tuor slew Othrod, a lord of the orcs, cleaving his helm, and Balkmeg he hewed asunder, and Lug he smote with his axe that his limbs were cut from beneath him at the knee. But Ecthelion shore through two captains of the goblins at a sweep, and cleft the head of Orcoval, their chiefest champion, to his teeth. And by reason of the great doughtiness of those two lords, they came even unto the Balrogs. Of those demons of power, Ecthelion slew three, for the brightness of his sword cleft the iron of them, and did hurt to their fire, and they writhed. Yet of the leap of that axe Dromboleg that was swung by the hand of Tuor, were they still more afraid, for it sang like the rush of eagles' wings in the air, and took death as it fell, and five of them went down before it. But so it is that few cannot fight always against the many, and Ecthelion's left arm got a sore rent from a whip of the Balrogs, and his shield fell to earth even as that dragon of fire drew nigh amid the ruin of the walls. Then Ecthelion must lean on Tuor, and Tuor might not leave him, though the very feet of the trampling beast were upon them, and they were like to be overborne. But Tuor hewed at a foot of the creature so that flames spouted forth, and that serpent screamed, lashing with its tail, and many of both orcs and Naldali got their death therefrom. Now Tuor gathered his might and lifted Ecthelion, and amid a remnant of the folk got thereunder and escaped the drake. Yet dire was the killing of men that beast had wrought, and the Gondolfin were sorely shaken. Thus it was that Tuor, son of Pele, gazed before the foe, fighting as he yielded ground, and bore from that battle Ecthelion of the Fountain. But the drakes and the foemen held half the city and all the north of it. Thence marauding bands fared about the streets and did much ransacking, or slew in the dark men and women and children, and many, if occasion let, they bound and led back and flung in the iron chambers amid the dragons of iron, that they might drag them afterward to be thralls of Melko. Now Tuor reached the square of the Folkwell by a way entering from the north, and found there Goldor denying the western entry by the Arch of Inwe to a horde of the goblins. But about him was now but a few of those men of the tree. There did Goldor become the salvation of Tuor, for he fell behind his men, stumbling beneath Ecthelion over a body that lay in the dark, and the orcs had taken them both but for the sudden rush of that champion and the dint of his club. There were the scatterlings of the guard of the Wing, and of the houses of the Tree and the Fountain, and of the Swallow and the Arch, welded to a good battalion, and by the counsel of Tuor they gave way out of that place of the well, seeing that the square of the king that lay next was the more defensible. Now that place had aforetime contained many beautiful trees, both oak and poplar, around a great well of vast depth and great purity of water. Yet at that hour it was full of the riot and ugliness of those hideous people of Melko, and those waters were polluted with their carcasses. Thus comes the last stout gathering of those defenders in the square of the palace of Tuorgon. Among them are many wounded and fainting, and Tuor is weary for the labors of the night and the weight of Ecthelion, who is in a deadly swoon. Even as he led that battalion in by the road of archers from the northwest, and they had much ado to prevent any foe getting behind their backs, a noise arose at the eastward of the square, and lo, Glorfindel is driven in with the last of the men of the Golden Flower. Now these had sustained a terrible conflict in the great market to the east of the city, where a force of orcs led by Balrogs came on them at unawares as they marched by a circuitous way to the fight about the gate. This they did to surprise the foe upon his left flank, but were themselves ambuscaded. There fought they bitterly for hours, till a fire drake new come from the breach overwhelmed them, and Glorfindel cut his way out very hardly and with few men. Of that place, with its stores and its goodly things of fine workmanship, was a waste of flames. The story tells that Turgon had sent the men of the harp to their aid because of the urgency of messengers from Glorfindel, but Sulgaunt concealed this bidding from them, saying they were to garrison the square of the lesser marker to the south, where he dwelt, and they fretted thereat. Now, however, they break from Sulgaunt and were come before the king's hall, and that was very timely, for a triumphant press of foemen was at Glorfindel's heels. On these the men of the harp, unbidden, fell with great eagerness and utterly redeemed the cravenhood of their lord, driving the enemy back into the market, and being leaderless, fared even over wrathfully, so that many of them were trapped in the flames or sank before the breath of the serpent that reveled there. Tuor now drank of the great fountain and was refreshed, and loosening Ecthelion's helm gave him to drink, splashing his face that his swoon left him. Now those lords Tuor and Glorfindel clear the square and withdraw all the men they may from the entrances and bar them with barriers, save as yet on the south. Even from that region comes now Egalmoth. He had had charge of the engines on the wall, but long since deeming matters to call rather for handstrokes about the streets than shooting upon the battlements, he gathered some of the arch and of the swallow about him and cast away his bow. Then did they fare about the city dealing good blows whenever they fell in with bands of the enemy. Thereby he rescued many bands of captives and gathered no few wandering and driven men, and so got to the king's square with hard fighting. And men were fain to greet him, for they had feared him dead. Now are all the women and children that had gathered there or been brought in by Egalmoth stowed in the king's halls, and the ranks of the houses made ready for the last. In that host of survivors are some, be it however few, of all the kindred save of the Hammer of Wrath alone, and the king's house is as yet untouched. Nor is this any shame, for their part was ever to bide fresh to the last and defend the king. But now the men of Melko have assembled their forces, and seven dragons of fire are come with orcs about them and Balrogs upon them down all the ways from north, east, and west, seeking the square of the king. Then there was carnage at the barriers, and Egalmoth and Tuor went from place to place of the defense, but Ecthelion lay by the fountain. And that stand was the most stubborn valiant that is remembered in all the songs or in any tale. Yet at long last a drake bursts the barrier to the north, and there had once been the issue of the Alley of Roses and a fair place to see or to walk in, but now there is but a lane of blackness, and it is filled with noise. Tuor stood then in the way of that beast, but was sundered from Egalmoth, and they pressed him backward even to the center of the square nigh the fountain. There he became weary from the strangling heat, and was beaten down by a great demon, even Gothmog, lord of Balrogs, son of Melko. But lo, Ecthelion, whose face was of the pallor of grey steel, and whose shield arm hung limp at his side, strode above him as he fell, and that gnome drave at the demon, yet did not give him his death, getting rather a wound to his sword arm that his weapon left his grasp. Then leapt Ecthelion, lord of the fountain, fairest of the Norderly, full at Gothmog even as he raised his whip. And his helm that had a spike upon it he drave into that evil breast, and he twined his legs about his foeman's thighs. And the Balrog yelled and fell forward. But those two dropped into the basin of the king's fountain, which was very deep. There found that creature his bane, and Ecthelion sank steel-laden into the depths, and so perished the lord of the fountain after fiery battle in cool waters. Note 30. The death of Ecthelion in the primary text of Tuor A is legible. The revision introduced a few changes of wording, but no more. End of note. Now Tuor had arisen when the assault of Ecthelion gave him space. And seeing that great deed, he wept for his love of that fair gnome of the fountain. But being wrapped in battle, he scarce cut his way to the folk about the palace. There, seeing the wavering of the enemy by reason of the dread of the fall of Gothmog, the marshal of the hosts, the royal house laid on, and the king came down in splendor among them and hewed with them, that they swept again much of the square, and the Balrogs slew even 20, which is a very great prowess indeed. But greater still did they do, for they hemmed in one of the fire drakes for all his flaming, and forced him into the very waters of the fountain, that he perished therein. Now this was the end of that fair water, and its pools turned to steam, and its spring was dried up, and it shot no more into the heaven, but rather a vast column of vapor arose to the sky, and the cloud therefrom floated over all the land. Then dread fell on all for the doom of the fountain, and the square was filled with mists of scalding heat and blinding fogs, and the people of the royal house were killed therein by heat, and by the foe, and by the serpents, and by one another. But a body of them saved the king, and there was a rally of men beneath Glingol and Bonsil. Then said the king, "Great is the fall of Gondolin." And men shuddered, for such were the words of Amnon the prophet of old. Note 31. This sentence from "And men shuddered" was added to Tuor B. On the prophecy, see 1-172. End of note. But Tuor, speaking wildly for ruth and love of the king, cried, "Gondolin stands yet, and Ulmo will not suffer it to perish." Now were they at that time standing, Tuor by the trees and the king upon the stairs, as they had stood aforetime when Tuor spake the embassy of Ulmo. But Turgon said, "Evil have I brought upon the flower of the plain in despite of Ulmo, and now he leaveth it to wither in the fire. Lo, hope is no more in my heart for my city of loveliness, but the children of the Naldali shall not be worsted forever." Then did the Gondothlim clash their weapons, for many stood nigh, but Turgon said, "Fight not against doom, O my children. Seek ye who may safety in flight, if perhaps there be time yet. But let Tuor have your lealty." But Tuor said, "Thou art king." And Turgon made answer, "Yet no blow will I strike more." And he cast his crown at the roots of Glingol. Then did Galdor, who stood there, pick it up, but Turgon accepted it not. And Bear of Head climbed to the topmost pinnacle of that white tower that stood nigh his palace. There he shouted in a voice like a horn blown among the mountains, and all that were gathered beneath the trees and the foemen in the mists of the square heard him, "Great is the victory of the Naldali!" And 'tis said that it was then middle night, and that the orcs yelled in derision. Then did men speak of a sally, and were of two minds. Many held that it were impossible to burst through, nor might they even so get over the plain or through the hills, and that it were better therefore to die about the king. But Tuor might not think well of the death of so many fair women and children, were it at the hands of their own folk in the last resort, or by the weapons of the enemy, and he spake of the delving and of the secret way. Therefore did he counsel that they beg Tuor to have other mind, and coming among them lead that remnant southward to the walls and the entry of that passage. But he himself burnt with desire to fare thither, and know how Idril and Earendel might be, or to get tidings hence to them, and bid them begone speedily. For Gondolin was taken. Now Tuor's plan seemed to the lords desperate indeed, seeing the narrowness of the tunnel and the greatness of the company that must pass it. Yet would they fain take this reed in their straits. But Turgon hearkened not, and bid them fare now, ere it was too late. "And let Tuor," said he, "be your guide and your chieftain, but I, Turgon, will not leave my city, and will burn with it." Then sped they messengers again to the tower, saying, "Sire, who are the Gondothlim, if thou perish? Lead us." But he said, "Lo, I abide here." And a third time, and he said, "If I am king, obey my behests, and dare not to parley further with my commands." After that they sent no more and made ready for the forlorn attempt. But the folk of the royal house that yet lived were